This is The Takeout.
Ask not what your country can do for you.
With Major Garrett.
Mr. Gorbachev, tear down this wall.
At this defining moment, change has come to America.
And we will make America great again.
Welcome to the very best part of my broadcast week. I'm Major Garrett. You already knew that. I'm joined by Steve Shigaris, the world's greatest podcast sidekick and the political director of CBS News. Hello, Steve.
Hello, Major.
As you see on CBSN, and I will tell you in the podcast world, we are at District Taco having breakfast. Our tacos are all assembled because The Takeout is having actual takeout. And we're going to have a lot of fun with this episode because we're going to do something that's a little daring. That is to say, we're going to try to put together a unified theory of economics from the end of World War II to present day and explain that unified theory of economic trends and how they relate to the politics of our time, specifically the politics behind Donald Trump. And our guest, I'm delighted to say, is a gentleman who you may know of, and if you don't, you're going to be fascinated by, Mark Blythe. Now, he is a political economist at Brown University. He's also a YouTube sensation. Small parts of his lectures or commentary on economic trends and political Trumpism, if you will, have received hundreds of thousands of likes and shares. One four-minute clip on Facebook has been shared more than a million times. He has a YouTube page. He also, in a previous life, the same life he lived, it's just the previous life to the one he's living now, stand-up comic, disco bouncer, chef, and mixologist. A renaissance man, to be sure. Mark Blythe, thank you for joining us on the Takeout Podcast.
It's a pleasure to have tacos.
It's a pleasure to have tacos. It most certainly is. Breakfast tacos, all corn tortilla. That is our preference here at the Takeout. We talked about this before we went on air. This is an ambitious project we are going to commence. Help our audience understand post-World War II economic order, America and Europe, the prosperity that came with it, and how that transformed in the 70s and 80s and 90s to the economy we have now that leaves many Americans and many Europeans not only dissatisfied, but enraged.
All right. Let's get started. In 1943, in the basement of the London School of Economics, there was a Hungarian economist by the name of Mikhail Kaletsky, and he writes a seven-page essay about how what we're planning to do after the war, which is to make full employment the most important thing, is going to come apart at the seams. And he predicts the 1970s. So that's our theory, and I'm going to explain that to you in terms of what happened. So imagine you're in 1945, maybe 1946. The world is in ruins. 50 million dead just from World War II. 20 million dead plus from World War I. The chaos of the 20s, the 30s, the rise of fascism, everything is falling apart. The US is 60% of world GDP, 60% of world finance. 50% of GDP, 60% of finance. Huge. Everyone else is dollar short. So what does the United States decide to do? Along with its allies at the Bretton Woods Conference in 1944, it said, we can't go back to just free markets and people doing whatever they want, because that was disastrous. If you allow money, particularly finance, to just do whatever it wants, it causes huge instabilities. It chases profits in the wrong places.
Creates rivalries.
Creates rivalries. So what we need to do is create national economies. Those national economies will restrict the flow of finance and will enable us to tax and spend and create a kind of hothouse where we force domestic investment to a high level and the policy target becomes full employment. We're not going to allow the unemployment of the Great Depression to come back because that leads to communism and fascism, and that ultimately is bad, bad, bad for business. So that was the target. Now, what did Kaletsky say? He said if you do this, you've got a problem, because if you isolate the economy and you close it off to financial flows and you make people invest at home, you're going to create a hothouse. And what that's going to do to labor markets is it's going to make wages more and more expensive over time. You're going to bid up the wage. And people at the top end of the wages are going to be able to say, hey, full employment, it doesn't cost me anything to move job to job. And I'm just going to ask for more and more money. Well, the only way the business can deal with this is if it pushes up prices to match. So what started to happen in the 70s was exactly what Kaletsky predicted, that wages and prices would rise together on a spiral. We called it inflation. And the problem with inflation is, if you're an investor, it's a tax on what you do. because it lowers your profitability. It increases uncertainty over the returns you're going to get 5 years, 10 years out. So essentially, the business classes of the West went on an investment strike. They stopped investing. And because of inflation. And when that happened, you had this simultaneous increase in unemployment and inflation. The classic stagflation of the 70s. All of this is in this 7-page piece in the Political Quarterly in 1943. Mm. So he predicts the whole thing. Now, that takes us to the 70s. What happens? This is the Reagan and Thatcher revolution. If you want to think about capitalism as, let's say, hardware, computer hardware, it can run various software programs. And the 45 to 75 software program was, it's all about full employment. And that created inflation, and that created the investment collapse, and that created the conditions for business to say, we need a new software. The new software was the neoliberal software. We're going to do the exact opposite. We're going to target price stability. We're going to care about inflation more than anything else. We're going to allow banks to do whatever the hell they want, get rid of the New Deal regulations, get rid of silos, get rid of all that stuff. And we're going to create a world of globalized markets and capital flows and supply chains, and it's going to be awesome. And it was awesome. But that system, too, had a flaw.
And what was that flaw?
Well, the flaw was the same as the one before. Once you allow capital to seek its return, it will try and seek its return. And if that means that you shut down industries in your areas and then move it abroad, then so be it. And if that's a market dynamic, and if one firm does that and makes profits and investors buy their stock because they're making more profits, if you don't do the same thing, you're going to get thumped.
And that empowered central banks, disempowered parliaments, congresses, and the people.
Absolutely, because at the end of the day, capitalism is run by investors, investors in firms. Once those firms go global, as they did beginning in the 80s and increasingly in the 90s, then the ability of domestic labor to demand their share of the profit split with capital really declines. And that begins the wage stagnation that we see in 1979, which continues all the way through to the present day, such that 60% of Americans, in real terms, adjusted for inflation, haven't really had a wage rise in over 30 years.
So was that period right after World War II an anomaly?
Total anomaly. Nothing like that had ever
happened. We look back on it as if that was the natural order of things. It was not the natural order of things.
It absolutely was not. And something else we do then is we also generalize from the inflation of the 70s and say, well, we always have to guard against inflation. But look what's happened since the financial crisis. Central banks around the world have chucked about $13 trillion into global money supply. There's no inflation anywhere. Both the way the world worked from the 40s to the 70s and the inflation of the 70s were unique, weird historical events. Where we are now is more like where capitalism has always been.
Translate that into the politics of our day, both right and left, in this sense of revulsion or dissatisfaction
sure.
with the economic hardware you just spoke of.
So think about it this way. If you have a system whereby profits will go to the highest return, if you have a system whereby capital is free to move around wherever it does, it's going to go global. It's going to seek the highest return. That's going to basically mean that there's going to be disproportionate rewards for people who are on the right end of that trade and less rewards for those on the other. That's the wage stagnation problem. Now, let's bring this down to sort of a basic level everyone can relate to. If you were around in 2005 and 2006, you probably had the same problem I had, which was getting through the front door because I had so many damn credit card offers blocking up the doorway. Because what we did was, finances, assets are our liabilities. We forget this. It all sums to zero, right? So I have a condo in Boston. The mortgage is what the bank likes. They don't want the condo. I hate the mortgage. I like the condo, right?
Right.
So when
your debt is their asset.
Your debt is their asset. So what happens when we just get stagnant? We fill it in with credit. We become credit card nation. And so long as the credit is free and so long as it's easy and everybody's under the illusion that you'll always have more money in the future and jobs will always give you more, et cetera, everyone loads up on private debt. And in the financial crisis, we found out how fragile that was. So what we're doing now is the collapse, if you will, of that second regime, that second order that went from 1980 through the financial crisis. It wasn't allowed to fail in the same way the 70s was. There was no reset because the central bank stepped in and bailed the whole system. And what we've been doing is basically keeping a system that's been on life support for 10 years, chugging along, hoping we can make it out of intensive care. The problem with that is the people whose wages haven't grown still haven't grown, who are still in debt are still in debt. And the ones who have made off with the most have even more. That's what's behind this politics. It's not about left, it's not about right. It's about the fact that wages haven't grown, debts have gone up, there's no inflation to eat away the debt this time. And that's what creates this politics.
You didn't think we could do it, did you? Ladies and gentlemen. condense almost 65, 70 years of global economics into one segment of this spectacular Takeout podcast, Mark Blythe just did it for you. You saw it on CBSN. You're listening to it in your podcast land, wherever that happens to be, and we thank you for that. Mark, when we come back from our break, I'm going to ask you about how this phenomenon, this hardware, and the dissatisfaction with it led to Trump, because I mentioned a Facebook posting of yours, 4 minutes, 1.2 million shares. That was in June 2016 when you said, Trump's going to win this. You all better figure this out. I wish I had seen that back then, because it would have helped me as I carried on covering that campaign throughout the year 2016. Mark Blythe, our guest, you are listening to The Takeout.
What they tapped into was a bunch of people who have seen the reality of having their community's assets stripped, have been sold down out, and then having politician after politician, both left and right, come to them for 25 years and say, vote for me, jobs, vote for me, better future. And every day and every week and every year, more people on meth, lower wages, more stress in the community, right? More crappy roads, more crappy schools. And finally, they just say, you know, I figured this out. You're all liars.
That's the voice of Mark Blythe. He appeared on the Jimmy Dore Show, February 8th, 2017, crystallizing for you and for the audience then the politics behind the rise of Donald Trump, I think it's fair to say. Mark, thank you for joining us. I want to let everyone know we're at District Taco, an outstanding taqueria here in Washington, D.C., DuPont Circle, very near the CBS News Bureau. This chain started as a food truck, and Mark, eventually we're going to talk about food trucks and modern economics, because I think there is something that we can deduce from the rise of food trucks and flexibility in the workforce and creativity in the workforce as a reaction to all these forces. You just talked about that, but before we get there, talk about Trumpism in America and if it is a global phenomenon and if it's about Trump or about these more deep-seated economic realities.
Okay, so the first thing to do is stop focusing on Trump if you want to understand this.
Got it.
Because he is the only guy on the right that's actually won an election as a populist. Look on the left. In Europe, what you've got is the complete transformation of half a dozen party systems. Jeremy Corbyn, remember the guy that like wasn't meant to be able to win anything, gets 4 million extra votes. This is a left. Think about Bernie, right? So this is a left phenomena and a right phenomena. And what it is essentially a huge amount of dissatisfaction with the people that have been running the world for the past 30 years. So you played that clip there. Let me sort of put that in context, right? My friend Nassim Taleb has a wonderful way of explaining this. Why is it that when we drive around and we have a choice of all the different foods you can get on the highways of the United States, we all go to McDonald's? And the answer is because it's really hard to get a bad McDonald's. But if you eat McDonald's all the time, bad things happen to you. So a large part of the United States has been eating McDonald's for 30 years. And they've figured out that there's a kitchen on the coasts that's feeding lobster Thermidor. And they're not invited. Mm. So what this election was is essentially calling people out and essentially saying, look, we live in communities whereby some of us have taken the type of loss of income that happened to Russia after the Cold War. We've become completely dependent on low-wage service sector jobs. Walmart's the largest employer in the country, etc. We've become completely cash-strapped. Because we've got low incomes, our credit is incredibly expensive. So we've got tons of debt. We're revolving debt. It's hard to pay this off. And we keep having politician after politician coming in from the left, right, telling us everything's great. It's not great. And this is the wake-up call. Trump walked into that. It was a coalition in waiting that just needed to be picked up. The Democrats were so tone-deaf, they walked right through it without even seeing it.
In that mold, I want to play a soundbite from J.D. Vance, the author of Hillbilly Elegy. He said this in February, and I want to get your reaction to this.
It may not be that Hillary Clinton could have solved the problem by campaigning more in rural Pennsylvania or suburban Southwest Ohio. The problem may just be that she spent so long among a certain class of society, and that class of society is just not good at emotionally connecting with another class of society. And here I'm speaking of sort of the elites versus the broad middle.
So you frame it as an economic argument, but how much of this is a societal or even cultural argument that was a maybe Hillary Clinton failed at connecting with voters? And frankly, if she connected better with a small number of people, say 77,000 in Wisconsin, Michigan, and Pennsylvania, she'd be president today.
There's no doubt you can tell that story, because ultimately all economics is felt in a cultural way. Right? We don't just respond in some kind of stimulus as, well, I got $1,000 extra, I'll change my behavior, right? That's not what happens. And in the context of the politics of the United States, of course, this is like going to be refracted through these different cultural ways. But I would go further than what JD said in that case. What you have is a situation that Tom Frank did really, really nice piece on in The Guardian. You guys can go look it up. And he got the email hacks from Podesta, and then arranged them by frequency of names, of place names. Mm. So the very first one, if I remember correct, was Martha for Martha's Vineyard. Mm-hmm. Then it was the Hamptons. Then it was New York. Then it was San Francisco. And places where real people live, right. Never mentioned.
The elites.
It tells you a huge amount of information on that. Now, is that because they're venal people and they're horrible and they're all just charlatans? Maybe. But a more charitable interpretation is, it costs billions to run for office in this country. So what do? You go where the money is. Where's the money is in the Hamptons? What do you expect? It's not a great answer, but it's a reasonable one.
Speaking of the Hamptons and Martha's Vineyard, I don't believe anyone has requested one of these hyper-valuable, commoditized takeout podcast stickers, Steve, from the Hamptons or Martha's Vineyard, have they?
No. Massachusetts and New York, yes.
Yes.
But neither of those locales.
But I think closer to what I think Mark Blythe might argue, and we might embrace as something closer to real America, has asked for the Takeout Podcast sticker. Have they not?
Absolutely.
How do they get that, Steve?
Very easily. If you want your very own Takeout Podcast sticker signed by Major, send your request along with a self-addressed stamped envelope to Takeout Sticker, care of CBS News at 2020 M Street Northwest, Washington, D.C., 20036.
And just to be clear, if anyone from the Hamptons or Martha's Vineyard, which I've been to many times because I cover the President of the United States, so I was there with Bill Clinton when he was president, Barack Obama when he was president, if you want a sticker, we'll send you one.
Oh, absolutely.
We just haven't got any requests.
We're not going to turn anybody down.
We know our audience.
You request a sticker, it's yours.
So take Trump out of it. But in America, you might understand that's a little hard to do. He is such a force of personality and force of political reorganization, or what feels like reorganization, even to the party he putatively leads, the Republican Party. How can we take Trump out of it?
Well, it's more disorganization than anything else at this point. I mean, think about the number of jobs in federal agencies which haven't been filled, etc., and that a lot of this has sort of devolved basically into the lap of Ryan and a few other people in Congress to try and make 25 million people think that not having health care is a good idea. So there's a real question as to, you know, how much of a difference this has made. And this could be the ultimate tragedy of Trump. If he is elected by this undercurrent, maybe it's only 77,000. But the key thing is, you got five states that were the blue wall. And the blue wall fell down. And counties, on a county level, counties have voted for Obama twice in some cases, went for this guy. Then put this in the context that this is going on all across the world. Right? This is transforming party systems throughout Europe. Populism is a global phenomenon of left and right. Then you have to really take him out of it and look at the bigger picture here. And the bigger picture is simply a story of the breakdown of that regime, if you want to call it that, from the 80s through to the financial crisis, where basically a huge amount of wealth was generated globally, and it went into very few hands locally.
I want to play for our audience soundbite number 5, because this speaks to this phenomenon, this hardware at a generational level. Arden?
One thing the Republicans and the Democrats care about, we have to take care of our seniors, right? What's the poverty rate of seniors in the United States? It goes from a low of 4% to a high of about 9%. What's the poverty rate of millennials? 20 to 25%. What society shorts its young to feed its old? This one, because they're the ones who vote.
But let me ask you about this, because if you look at the Brexit vote, which was to many, in retrospect, kind of a foretelling of what was to happen in our country with President Trump versus Hillary Clinton. In both cases, the losing side of that proposition were younger, more optimistic, aspirational voters. The winning side was the more dissatisfied, elderly component of the electorate. And yet, according to this analysis and these underlying numbers, the old are better off, should have more reason to be satisfied and more reason to be optimistic, at least about their short-term future, than the millennials, who are taking the bigger disproportionate hit economically and should be much more pessimistic, but vote opposite that. Can you help me understand that?
I think that old people generally are more cranky. That might be it. Okay, the serious point is, let me give you a British example. So the Brits are justifiably proud of something called the National Health Service, which is their single-payer healthcare system. And it works, but it eats money like a dragon demon from hell. Now, the Brits privatized their higher education system without really anybody getting told that's what happened. They brought in fees, all the rest of it. And the bigger universities, Oxford and Cambridge, I mean, they're basically like Ivy League, right? So you'd think that'd be a huge balance sheet saving for the Brits. What would the Conservatives like to do? Another round of tax cuts, whatever, right? No, it all goes straight in the NHS. Now, what that means is, think of this as a generational story. When the boomers were young, they got to go to school for free. In fact, they got grants to go to school, and there were no fees. Now that they're old, young people have to borrow against their future earnings to get the skills that they need to survive, because we're spending the money we've got now keeping the boomers alive. That's an intergenerational transfer. That's politics, but we never talk about it. Brexit, Trump, all that has got that stuff written through it. It's not defined by the generational politics, but it's part of it and an important part.
That's the voice of Mark Blythe, our guest for the Takeout Podcast. We are at District Taco having a fantastic breakfast. More on politics, economics, being a mixologist, a chef, a disco bouncer, and a stand-up comic.
And a bass player.
All of those things Mark Blythe was, in addition to being a kind of oddity in the academic world, an internet sensation. We'll talk about that, too, on the other side of this break. You're listening to The Takeout.
The digital disruption has already happened. World's largest taxi company owns no taxis. Largest accommodation provider has no real estate. Largest phone companies have no telecoms infrastructure. Most valuable retailer has no inventory. Most popular media owner creates no content. Fastest growing banks have no actual money. World's largest movie house owns no cinemas. And the largest software vendors don't write the apps.
That's Mark Blythe talking about the digital disruption. Mark, what is the digital disruption? That's kind of an example of it. But let me ask you, so what's the largest movie house that owns no cinemas?
Netflix.
Got it. What's the fastest growing bank that has no actual money?
It was LendingTree, but they got into trouble.
Right. Is Bitcoin part of that?
Bitcoin is
or is a currency phenomenon?
Bitcoin is basically people selling bits of the sky to each other because they're enamored with technology. It makes no sense whatsoever.
Got it. Love that. Most valuable retailer that has no inventory?
Amazon? eBay.
eBay.
Or Amazon.
eBay
has inventory, but Amazon basically, yeah.
Largest phone company that has no telecom infrastructure?
Skype.
There you go. Largest taxi company, that would be
Uber.
Right. Largest accommodations provider, no real estate, that's Airbnb. Outstanding. This disruption, irreversible?
No, it's completely reversible. People think technology is a force of nature. It's not. It's a force of humans. Humans can be stopped. Watch Game of Thrones. So
should it be stopped?
Well, here's the way tech people always talk about this. Think about the example of driverless cars, right? So I just read Ed Luce's book, and he's got a nice little line, and he says, in the United States, more people drive than make things. So this is a huge part of the labor market. And the conversation is, hey, you know, you went through that financial crisis, your wages haven't increased, you're strapped for cash. Hey, millennials, take on more debt and then not get a job. We've got an idea. Why don't we just replace everyone with robots? Right, I mean, talk about politically tone deaf, right? Now, let's suppose that digital disruption means automated cars, for example, right? I don't want an automated car. I drive a really nice car. I like to watch Top Gear, and I'm like a bad person that way, I suppose. But nonetheless, it's all supply side, right? Because the tech exists, it will happen. No. Remember Segway? Mm. Right? Yeah, that was meant to happen.
A lot of supply.
A lot of supply.
Not much demand.
Very little demand. So these things should always be taken with a pinch of salt. But the key thing is, are they transforming labor markets? And yes, they are.
We have a question from Arden Fari, our esteemed producer. Arden, please approach the microphone.
Sure. It's actually a series of questions all under the heading of one question. But are you a Republican or a Democrat?
Neither.
Did you vote for Trump or Hillary?
Hillary.
And do you consider yourself liberal or conservative?
Neither. I'm on the left. I'm closer to Bernie than anybody else.
Did you vote for him in the primary?
I did not register in the primary because I'm not registered as a Democrat.
Thank you.
There we go. Steve Shigaris, world's greatest podcast sidekick.
Well, he mentioned Bernie. I want to get into that in a second, but I do want to follow up on the digital divide question. Is that also play into this sort of cultural divide issue, elites versus everybody else? And is there a sense that automated cars, for instance, does the average person, they want to drive? That's a small town. That's a big city issue, and maybe a small town, they don't want automated cars. Is that a disconnect, you think, between Silicon Valley and many, many people in this country?
So here's an interesting stat I got from a guy that does commercial real estate. He shows a graph, and it's total sales of like department stores and retail and the whole thing. And then there's a line that's creeping up from the bottom, and it's getting bigger and bigger. And he says to the audience, what is this? And they all put their hands up and say, it's online. It's Amazon. It's destroying retail. And he goes, no, I just showed you a slide of catalog sales in the 1970s. Mm-hmm. What Amazon, those guys, effectively do is take up the catalog market. Right? Now, why are malls dying? Because they're in the wrong place. They're in places that have had huge losses of income and jobs, so people go to dollar stores. So, you know, the high-end mall dies, right? That's it. So much of this really has a simple economic underpinning. You know, we can reach for sort of like, well, what are the cultural consequences of this? And you can tell that story, but I think it's less interesting than what's underlying it. And what's underlying it is to tell the digital car story, right? You need 5G Wi-Fi everywhere to make this happen. This country can't fill potholes, right? So we're going to have like 5G Wi-Fi just magically popping up, and everybody's going to abandon their cars and go into some god-awful little pod with Google written on the side and be whisked around like brainless chickens? I don't think so.
Yeah, and you mentioned the 5G Wi-Fi. I was just reading something the other day that says that this idea of getting Wi-Fi in rural areas is getting resistance from the Wi-Fi providers because...
Yeah, that's their business model. Absolutely.
Right, that's right. Let me play something from... We mentioned Bernie Sanders earlier. I want to get your take on generally what you're hearing from people today about how to deal with these economic issues you set up. Let me play this bite from, number 8 from Bernie Sanders. This was him in Montana, of all places, campaigning for the Democratic candidate in the special election there back in May, who wound up not winning that election. But, Arden?
It's economically and morally unacceptable that today the top 0.1% own almost as much wealth as the bottom 90%. And while people in Montana and people in Vermont, people all over this country are working 2 or 3 jobs to put food on the table to take care of their families, 52% of all new income generated today goes to the top 1%.
So that's classic Bernie stump speech stuff. That's classic sort of populism, right, in a sense?
No, why is that populism?
No?
I mean, to me, populism is it's all about me. I'm the guy that can solve problems. Everyone else is corrupt. I'm the only person that could force change. It's all about me. That's populism. That's not what I'm hearing.
So Trump is populism.
Trump is to a certain extent populism, but I think basically his authoritarian instincts are being amplified by a media that wants to portray him as far more dangerous than he's proven to be so far.
The bigger question is this. You see Trump, you hear Bernie Sanders, you heard Hillary Clinton, you're hearing Elizabeth Warren, you're hearing people all over the spectrum talk about how we need to fix what is going wrong with this country, especially economically. Are you hearing solutions that are actually feasible, or are you just hearing stump speeches?
I'm hearing feasible ones, and let's take a lesson from China, of all places, right? So China wants to become a large consumption-driven economy. It doesn't want to live off exports anymore because it's fickle, right? If we blow up, their export market dies, they die too. So they want to have more spending internally. The problem is they have no real welfare state despite being communists, and people massively oversave. You got to save for education, you got to save for healthcare, whatever. And you got a huge income inequality problem as well. People's Bank of China does more research on inequality and its political effects than anywhere else I know. So what do? They decide to build massive infrastructure, particularly transport. Why? Because that lowers the cost of getting to work. They're then investing massively in education and making it free. Why? Because then you don't have to save for education. Next up, a single-payer health system. Because when you do that, people suddenly don't have to save all the time. So if you lower how much people have to save, they can spend more. So if you want to give people a break, you can inflate away the debt by generating inflation, but that seems to be destructive and also hard to do. Another way would be, how about you actually take the big stuff off the table? Their education shouldn't cost nearly as much as it does, and there's no reason for it to do so. And why not take healthcare out? Because if you take care of the big stuff, then people's incomes go further, and they're able to take more risks, and they're able to achieve more in their lives. It's actually quite simple. There's nothing difficult about this. It's just that the people who have made off with all the gains don't want to stop that.
You mentioned something a while ago about the potential tragedy of Trump. How much do you think that's a potential reality, that the Trump moment will be a political one, but will have, in the end, no policy relevance to deal with the very real grievances of the people who thought he might do them well?
Sadly, I think that's shaping up to be the most likely outcome. That ultimately what you've got is someone who's portrayed himself as the people's champion, and he's come along and said, you know, we need to protect coal jobs. All right, great sympathy for the people who are there who do this, but coal mining in the developed world is shutting down everywhere. And there's a reason for this. In the past 2 years, China has installed more solar than the United States has. The price of solar is dropping precipitously. What did we do? Did we take this as an opportunity to redo our grid to lower the cost for business? No. We just went to the WTO and asked them to stick up effectively a tariff on the import of solar panels so we could protect our jobs. This is beyond short-sighted. And that type of thinking, while it's kind of like a little placebo in the short term, isn't going to help the people who are going to be displaced by technological change over the long run. And they're going to be even more frustrated and angry if the people's champion singularly fails them.
Before we conclude the Takeout podcast, three segment part, I want to ask you something about the 70s, Trump and Hillary Clinton. It seems, and I've said this before on this program, both are products of the 70s. Both are in their 70s, or nearly so. Hillary Clinton was a product of the 70s in that she embraced the neoliberal globalization ethos that evolved from the 70s to our present day. Donald Trump is a product of the 70s in the reverse, that he looked at the 50s and 60s and said that prosperity and that middle class comfort and prosperity is what I want to return to, and that singular definition of American strength and economic dominance is what I would like to return to. Is it possible that though Trump was in the moment politically relevant, he may not have what it takes to adapt to the future because he's spending so much time looking back?
So there's a phrase from the Greeks, which is a man can never stand in the same river twice because it's never the same river. And that's unfortunately the story of Back to the Future. You can't go back there because the conditions that made the United States so uniquely powerful and so able to set the rules and set up that full employment economy just aren't there anymore. And the technologies that make the world happen have changed drastically. And one final thing, aging matters. The whole of the West is getting old. We mentioned that they vote more, etc. But the really important one is this. The center of gravity economically is shifting to Asia. It's shifting to China, it's shifting to India, it's shifting to countries that have better demographic profiles, because when you're younger, you spend more. And with spending comes growth. Look at Germany. They're all over 40. They oversave. The rate of growth is terrible. Wages haven't risen. And they're Europe's success story. So there's a bigger problem than that. But all of that compounds. You can't go back to the future.
That's a bit bleak. We're going to, before we end, ask you one optimistic thing, because we're a district talker. We had a fabulous breakfast. This chain started as a food truck. Explain briefly how food trucks relate to the evolving economy in America.
In brief, all right, so a buddy of mine got a food truck. He used to work in a bank. Hated it. His wife has a real job. She bankrolls the family. He invests in the food truck. It's doing well. It's actually really hard work. It's a lot of prep. 4 days a week is the most he can do. He loves it. So the flexibility of the modern economy, the digital disruption, all the things that you can do now, food trucks, if you've got those skills, if you've got those assets, it's kind of the best of times. But what happens if you're on the other side of that deal? What if you're on what the Brits called zero-hour contracts? Santander, the big Spanish bank, put their bank staff on what are called zero-hour contracts. You literally don't know how many hours you're going to work this week. Right? What if your benefits are constantly being cut? What if every single time you negotiate a deal, it gets worse? Taxi drivers used to have 4 years security on contracted airports. Now they've got nothing. You don't know if it's going to be there. What happens if Uber takes your job? So it depends where you are in the labor market. For some people, food trucks is a metaphor for the best of times, flexibility, doing what you want, realizing your dream. For other people, that dream's a bit of a nightmare.
Mark Blythe, our guest for this episode of The Takeout, an outstanding guest, a theorist, an explainer, and damn funny, if I might say so myself. We'll get to that in the Takeout Outtake Especial. You've been listening to The Takeout, and we also, again, thank District Taco for being a lovely host.
Get in my belly!
We are in our belly. We have been in the belly.
The Takeout is produced by Arden Farhi, Nick Feynman, Katiana Krachenko, and CBS Radio News. Follow us on Facebook and Twitter and visit takeoutpodcast.com for more information.
And I said, Jim, let me ask you a question. How's Paris doing?
Paris? I don't go there anymore. Paris is no longer Paris.